I invite your attention to the reading of the Word of God, verses which I have previously selected from the 33rd Psalm. Rejoice in the Lord, O ye righteous. Praise is indeed comely for the upright. O give thanks unto the Lord with the harp. Sing praises unto him with the psaltery of 10 strings. Sing unto him a new song. Play skillfully with a loud noise. For the word of the Lord is right, and all of the work of the Lord is done in righteousness. The Lord loveth righteousness and justice. The earth is full of the loving kindness of the Lord. The Lord bringeth the counsel of the nations to naught. He maketh the thoughts of the people to be of no effect at all. The counsel of the Lord stands fast forever. The thoughts of his heart stand for all generations. So blessed is the nation whose God is indeed the Lord's, the people whom he hath chosen for his own inheritance. There is no king saved by the multitude of a host. A mighty man is not delivered by strength. A horse is a vain thing for safety. Neither doth he deliver any by his great power. But let thy loving kindness, O Lord, be upon us, according as we have placed our hope in thee. And may God bless to our hearts the reading and the hearing of this portion of his word. The 33rd Psalm, from which I just read, is one of the great congregational hymns of Israel that were sung apparently on the occasion of some great national victory or anniversary of a victory. We cannot be sure from the context of this psalm precisely what that historical occasion was. Your guess would be as good as anybody else's. It's tempting, however, to say that the occasion could well have been that when Sennacherib was on his mighty march to destroy Judah, and Israel had her hopes blasted by the mighty army of Assyria. The leaders of Israel look toward Egypt. They've got Tommy guns and tanks and horses and cavalry. We don't even have a dozen horses at our disposal. What in the world are we going to do? And Isaiah said, all we can do, and all we better do, is to put our trust in Yahweh the Lord. Now I want to hasten to add, my friends, that this text should not and cannot rightly be used to argue against military preparation. Indeed, the Jews did what preparing they could, and they would have been stupid not to. But God knew their limitations. And it is this fact that we need to, notice. That in their strictly limited capacity for physical protection, that they turned their hope and faith in Yahweh the Lord. They did what they could. And the psalmist, perhaps the same one who wrote the 45th Psalm, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in time of trouble. The well-known psalm that Martin Luther used as a basis of his mighty, great, mighty hymn, Ein feste Burg ist unser Gott. A mighty fortress is our God. And so it may well be that this 33rd is one of those congregational hymns now, commemorating God's gracious providence in coming to Israel's rescue, in blessing her in her helplessness, and in establishing her as a nation. And so it's no wonder to me that as the psalmist, by the Spirit, expatiates on the providence of God in Israel in past years and centuries, says, oh, the loving kindness of God toward us as a nation has been so great and so undeserved. And yet we are his people, and in spite of the fact that we've often turned from him and don't deserve his goodness, his providence has blessed us. And then the psalmist says, blessed is that nation whose God is the Lord. And this, my friends, is really the text. While I'm not exactly disposed to trying to do textual so-called preaching, this is the text that I want to call to your attention. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. The first thing I want to say is that we should make the distinction in our minds between Israel and the United States of America. Of course, the difference is obvious chronologically, historically, separated by centuries. But we must remember that Israel was purely a theocratic nation. God was her king. She had no earthly ruler. We, because of the fact that men some two centuries ago or more, who loved the Lord and wanted to be able to practice religious freedom, braved their enemies and unknown dangers to come to this land, established this nation, at the shedding of blood, at the losing of loved ones, of fortunes and lives, that we might have a nation where we can worship God. That's why we were established. One nation, under God. But, you see, we, by our indifference and carelessness, have flouted our obligation to keep this a Christian nation under God. And we have allowed the forces of the infidels and the atheists and others to speak loud when we have been strangely silent. And now we are in trouble and want God to help us. It's a crying shame that our great nation is not free to honor God publicly as a nation. We were founded for this reason. Well, of course, we do give lip service to it. The Congress begins with prayer. I remember reading with interest the introductory prayers by Peter Marshall. Some of them are rather catchy things, but I know Peter Marshall was a man of great Christian experience and faith, and those were great prayers. And our Congress heard his prayers to God with, I think, appreciation, and perhaps some responded and what have you. But then, you see, the forces of others say that when we say that we want freedom under God, others say we don't want God. We don't want you to have him either. And we have yielded to their pressures. And I say again, we're in trouble. And it's going to take even God, and I say this reverently, a long time to get us out from under the lethargy and the indifference and the nonchalance and ingratitude that have characterized our thinking and our acting for all these years. We still, I say, give some kind of lip service. We put on our money in God we trust. And it's a big lie. You know it is. But we say that. Now, I say these things simply to remind you that while our nation is not Israel, yet our nation was founded, really, with the same sort of import, if you please, a nation whose God is the Lord. In God we trust. One nation, under God. This was our founding principle. Let us make our contribution to return speedily, we better, to that principle. Now, another point that I want to make, and it really comes to light in this psalm and other psalms that deal with the national spirit of Israel. It's important that they give to patriotism. It distresses me that the word patriotism in our country has come under a cloud. I'm ashamed to say that perhaps some of the most outspoken objectors to emphasis on patriotism has come from the clergy. And I don't appreciate it. It hadn't come from this one. But we shy away from too much emphasis on the uniqueness of our country. Yes, I'm a patriot. I thank God that I am a citizen of the United States of America. I hesitate to use the word an American because the Mexican can say the same thing and the Brazilian can say the same thing and what have you, because they are all Americans. We are not America, my friends. I can't help it. We are not America. We are the United States of America. There are other countries in America. Canada is America. But we are the United States of America and not a democracy, thank God, but a republic. And this is as it should be. And I trust that we can be patriots again and emphasize patriotism. And I should like, for a moment or two, to show you that this is no empty sort of a challenge that I'm asking you to think about, but that it has always been a proper sort of approach in history. Even among the Jewish people, don't you suppose David was reckoned as a patriot? He began mighty early as a young lad. He didn't have a Tommy gun or a rifle or a tank, but he had a sling and a couple of two or three smooth stones from the brook, and apparently was a pretty good marksman at that, and I'm glad he was. And with very great skill, caused to fall one giant that terrified the whole Israelitish army. David was a patriot. And if you read the book of Kings and Chronicles, you'll see how they, really, they honored him for that. And later, David was a well-known patriot, and David's friend Jonathan and others were patriots, if you please. I'm not, as you well know, a historian, but I do like some aspects of history. And one of the great poems that used to intrigue me when I was at high school was found in Thomas Babington Macaulay's Lays of Ancient Rome. Lays, L-A-Y-S, Tales of Ancient Rome. And I don't know where Macaulay got all of the details of these background for these poems, but they're the most fascinating things. If you and your children have not read them, you ought to get them to reading good literature. And this is among the best. And this is a long poem. I used to know most of it. I never did memorize all of it. But I've got it in front of me. I'm not going to trust my memory anymore at my age. I learned better than that. But that poem, Horatius at the Bridge. This bridge now that was built across the Tiber River. When Adelaide and I were in Rome some years ago, we crossed the Tiber several times on different bridges. And I remember asking our tour guide whether he knew about where the old bridge was that used to cross the Tiber where Horatius Cocles defended it so courageously as a patriot and citizen of Rome. And he said, unfortunately, no, we do not know precisely where. But he did give an area in which it must have been. That bridge, which was called the Pons Subricius, a bridge made of pilings. And the story is that the Etruscans were about to capture Rome. They had to cross the Tiber River. The only way to cross it was across that bridge, a very narrow wooden bridge. And as they got the news that the Etruscans were coming with a mighty army, well armed and well equipped, the city fathers got very much concerned. What are we going to do to protect our city? Are we going to meet them and say, well, we can't do anything, so we just yield to you? I'm glad they didn't do that. They said, we've got to do something. And so there was one patriot, a patriot named Horatius Cocles. He saw the situation and saw this narrow bridge and knew that this mighty army had to cross it. And he said to the council, to the mayor of the city, Sir Council, I, with two more to help me, will hold the enemy in play while you and your helpers cut down the bridge. Some of you may remember this story. I, with two more to help me, will hold the foe in play. And I want to read, because I think it's worth reading, just a couple of stanzas. Maybe just if for no other reason than to challenge you to go home and read some of this. It is a myth, but it emphasizes patriotism. But the council's brow was sad, and the council's speech was low, and darkly looked he at the wall, and darkly at the foe. Their van will be upon us before the bridge goes down. And if they once win the bridge, what hope to save the town? Then outspake brave Horatius, the captain of the gate, to every man upon this earth death cometh soon or late. And how can man die better than facing fearful odds, and so on? Hew down the bridge, sir council, with all the speed you may. I, with two more to help me, will hold the foe in play. In yon straight path a thousand may well be stopped by three. Now who will stand on either side, on either hand, and keep the bridge with me? And here we find some more patriots. Thank God for patriots. Then outspake furious Lartius. Iranian proud was he. Lo, I'll stand at your right hand and keep the bridge with thee. And outspake strong Herminius. Of Titian blood was he. I will abide on thy left side and keep the bridge with thee. Horatius, quoth the council, as thou sayest, so let it be. And straight against that great array went forth the dauntless three. For Romans in Rome's quarrel spared neither land nor gold, nor son nor wife, nor limb nor life in the brave days of old. Then none was for a party, then all were for the state. Then the great man helped the poor man loved the great. Then spoils were fairly sold. The Romans were like brothers in the brave days of old. And one other stanza and I quit. This shows after this great army gets to the bridge and they see these three men standing to stop them. And of course, they laughed. 3 men to stop 30,000 soldiers. And 3 or 4 of them got down, and they selected 3 of their men to come and deal with these 3 Romans. Stout Lysias hurled down on us into the stream beneath. First one that came from the Etruscan army, Lysias cut his head open and sent him down. Herminius struck at Cius and clove him to the teeth. At Picus, brave Horatius darted 1 fiery thrust, and the proud Umbrian's gilded arms clashed in the bloody dust. Well, there is patriotism. Now, I'm not as gory as that text sounds. But my friends, God give us some patriots. I do not know what lies ahead for our nation. Only God knows. But should the time come, what would you do? Patriotism. Our Christian duty, my friends, is to make this nation a Christian nation. And I must say, we've wasted far too much time through the years, through the last decade, doing so many things that are good in themselves, and nobody could put us in jail for doing them or really find any fault with them. But there were things that really were not basic and not in any sense contributing to the stamina of our nation and to the warp and woof of our people. And here we are, a nation, even as Christians, many of us have no will to defend anything anymore. And it's a shame. It's a crying shame. I hope by the grace of God that our great nation, and it is a great one, will never have to lift arms. And I hope that we can be used in our witness to persuade those who are responsible in our nation to stop people from making arms. There are too many people in our nation getting rich from making implements of war. Blessed indeed is that nation whose God is the Lord. Now, you know that I had no idea, because I don't want to get put in jail by tomorrow morning, of telling you what to do on Tuesday morning or Tuesday. A very important day in our nation's history. Very important, my friends. And many Christian people have been indifferent about their privilege and obligation as citizens of this great nation. And because of our indifference, we have gotten ourselves in a bind, and we don't know how to get out. And so come next Tuesday, we're going to be in a position of having to casting a ballot. I would not think of trying to tell you how to vote, because I am not sure that I know how. But I do challenge each of us to be much in prayer for our nation, and that we pray that God may give us the wisdom to do what is right on Tuesday. I'm not going to presume to tell you what it is. And this is not wishful thinking or being wishy-washy or being on two sides of the fence at one time. That is not what I'm doing at all. You have a perfect right to cast your ballot. And may God give you the grace and the courage and the wisdom to cast it as best you know how. But do it! Do it! And get your friends likewise to do it. And then, regardless of the results that will be coming in, no doubt, over the TV screen here tonight and maybe all hours of the morning, no matter what the result, let us continue our prayers that God bless us as a nation and use us to be leaven to strengthen our nation, that men and women all through our land may come to recognize that no nation is safe unless that nation honors the Lord of all nations and lands. God, give us the grace and the strength to do this. What makes a nation great? Alexander Blackman wrote these lines, and with this I close. Not serried ranks with flags unfurled, not armored ships that gird the world, not hoarded wealth or busy mills, not cattle on 1,000 hills, not sages wise, nor schools, nor laws, not boasted deeds in freedom's cause. All these may be, and yet the state in the eyes of God be far from great. That land is great which knows the Lord, whose songs are guided by His word, where justice rules twixt man and man, where love controls in art and plan, where, breathing is his native air, each soul finds joy in praise and prayer. Thus may our country, good and great, be God's delight. Man's best estate.